immediately when we found out, we took action to protect our staff and to make sure that he did not have access to the schools anymore.
Disturbing sexual assault allegations against a former principal in Sitka. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, celebrating the 100-year anniversary of Alaska's first territorial legislature.
The first speech made by the Speaker of the House was against federal overreach and taking too much control away from Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Three are dead in a light plane crash near Rainy Pass. The plane went missing yesterday afternoon on a trip from Anchorage to Tocotna. The Cessna 182 was headed to Tocotna from Anchorage's Merrill Field, but it did not reach its destination. A search was launched, and shortly past 10 a.m. today, an Air National Guard helicopter crew spotted the wreckage high up Rainy Pass. Pararescuers determined there were no survivors. Kayla Ruff is a spokeswoman for the Air National Guard.
We were able to get on scene, and our Guardian Angel Pararescue team was able to get inside the aircraft, and unfortunately, all three people were found deceased.
The victims are 59-year-old pilot Ted Smith, Carol Sorvoja, 48 years old, and 10-year-old Rosemarie Sorvoja. All were from Eagle River. The plane was not flying as part of the Iditarod Air Force, but Sorvoja family spokesman David Morris said they were heading to Tocotna to volunteer for the race. Rupp says the pilot had a personal locator beacon in his vest and a 406 emergency locator transmitter on board. She says the pilot was experienced and traveled well-equipped for emergencies. The National Transportation Safety Board is expected to investigate. A former principal in Sitka has been indicted on charges of sexual assault. A Sitka grand jury on Friday charged 54-year-old Joe Robidoux on 6 counts of felony sexual assault. He also faces an additional 5 misdemeanor charges. Prosecutors say all of the incidents involve adult women who worked for Robidoux when he was principal of Blatchley Middle School and that students at the school were not involved. A word of caution, some of the charges we're about to describe might not be suitable for younger listeners. Court documents say he exposed himself, in some cases inside empty classrooms. The felony charges come from accusations that he touched some of the women without their permission or forced them to touch him. The incidents are alleged to have happened between last May and as recently as January, both in the school building and at some of the women's homes. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
The first accusation came to light 1 week after Robidoux moved from his job at Blatchley to the district office, where he had just been hired as business manager. Superintendent Steve Bradshaw was in Juneau on Monday, but listened in by phone as KCAW interviewed Mary Wegner, the assistant superintendent of schools.
There's a lot of rumors saying that he was promoted because of this, and we found out afterwards, and it's important that the public know that immediately when we found out, we took action to protect our staff and to make sure that he did not have access to the schools anymore.
District officials say Robidoux left the principalship at Blatchley on Friday, January 11th. He began as business manager the following Monday, January 14th. Wegner says at the end of that week, on January 18th, one staff member came forward with allegations.
It was the police investigation that uncovered the second staff member and the substitute teacher. So we as a district don't even have a lot of the details. We only know what the one person chose to disclose to me. And then with the evidence that was presented just through her sharing, we immediately turned it over to the police for their investigation and then stopped our investigation so that we weren't stepping on the police's toes.
Wegner and Bradshaw both say Robidoux was placed on administrative leave as soon as the allegations were made. He tendered his resignation sometime during that leave, and it became effective March 1st. Sitka attorney Jim McGowan represented Robidoux at his arraignment on Friday. He said his client would not comment to reporters on the allegations. Robidoux will be represented by Juneau attorney Julie Willoughby for further proceedings. She also declined to comment. Officials from the school district and assistant district attorney Gene Seaton stressed that, as far as they know, students did not witness any of the alleged incidents. Again, Assistant Superintendent Mary Wegner.
I know that with the one staff that did disclose to me, she said that there was no students that were present and that her door was locked.
Her classroom door was locked,
but students were in the building.
The district did not officially say anything to parents or even most staff members before Friday's indictment. Wegner says they told police they would not go public until the police had concluded their investigation. Robidoux appeared in court Friday for arraignment. He is free on $7,500 bond. His next court appearance is scheduled for April 11th. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
While oil and gas companies are inching towards a new tax break in Juneau, they're fighting to maintain their preferential tax treatment in Washington, D.C. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the Senate Democratic budget is expected to take aim at some controversial tax privileges.
The Senate has not passed a budget in 4 years. Many contend a budget does not amount to more than a political document that forces senators on the record about what types of programs they're willing to pay for. But Idaho Republican Mike Simpson says it's a bit more than that. He's a leader on the House Appropriations Committee.
Partly they're message documents, but they're also documents by which we set the appropriation bills. I mean, if one passes the House and we can't get one past the Senate, as the last 4 years have indicated, we use that as our budgeting document on how far we can what we can put in the appropriation bills.
After years of chiding, Republicans will get their wish to see a Democratic-produced budget. That's set to come out next week. And it's widely expected to cut tax breaks for the profitable oil and gas industry. Jack Girard is the CEO of the American Petroleum Institute. That's the Oil and Gas Lobby Association in Washington. He says tax revenue from the industry is more beneficial to the government, some $86 million each day, than ending any tax breaks.
Do you want real revenue from economic activity, or do you want to be punitive with small provisions?
Girard says the tax credits he's looking to protect don't cost taxpayers much, about $2 to $4 billion per year. So he says any effort to end the industry's tax breaks looks like political posturing, not any real attempt to offset spending.
The provisions they're talking about are designed, in essence, to be punitive measures toward the industry.
Girard says that other industries get similar tax treatment and are not being singled out. Eric Toder disagrees. He says the oil and gas industry benefits from unique tax breaks.
This one doesn't apply to anybody but them.
Toder is a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury during the Clinton presidency. Now he's at the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center. He says some certain tax credits, like the one for expensing exploration and development, don't cost much but are unnecessary. They allow large and small oil companies to write off initial construction over the lifespan of the well.
Operating costs are always deductible. It's expensing in the development, which should be a capital expenditure.
Both of Alaska's senators have said they do not want to single out the oil industry, that they prefer comprehensive tax reform. Senator Lisa Murkowski says tax reform is just one piece of an overall deficit reduction package.
It looks pretty gloomy right now, but if we're going to be honest about how we're dealing with our fiscal issues and the reforms that are necessary, it's got to be reductions in spending on the discretionary side, but also on the mandatory side, but also tax reform has got to be a piece of it.
But most in Washington seem to think the further into this congressional term we get, the less likely we are to see any real tax reform. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Several dozen people gathered on the beach in Unalaska this afternoon to watch as Shell's damaged drill rig was towed into port. Four local tugs helped maneuver the 277-foot Kulik into Captain's Bay, while the tugs that towed the rig from Kodiak stood by. The Kulik will tie up at its specialized dock in the bay until the heavy lift vessel arrives to take it to dry dock in Asia. Shell spokesman Curtis Smith couldn't say when the heavy lift vessel is scheduled to arrive. According to its automated tracking system, the vessel left China on Sunday. Once it gets to Unalaska, it will empty its ballast tanks, sink below the Kulik, and then lift the drill rig onto its deck. Smith says Shell hasn't yet selected a shipyard for repairs to the damaged rig. Lawmakers in the State House of Representatives have trimmed Governor Sean Parnell's operating budget by 2%. The $9.7 billion budget was released yesterday, and every department except for corrections saw its funding decreased. Behavioral health services were reduced by $8 million, and $1 million was cut from early education. Leadership in the House and Senate have emphasized the need for a tighter budget with oil production on the decline. The state may be facing a deficit for the first time in nearly a decade and could tap into its $16 billion reserve fund. The Finance Committee is taking public testimony on the budget this week, and the bill could be up for a vote as soon as next week. After that, it will be sent to the Senate. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, St. George makes progress on building a new boat harbor on the island.
Without a functional harbor, in short order, that community will cease to exist.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Enjoy high school hoops in Anchorage during the 2013 ASAA March Madness State Basketball Championships, March 16th through the 23rd. Come early and stay late to enjoy Anchorage's big wildlife with events, shopping, dining, and activities for the whole family. For more information on what to see and do in Anchorage, explore anchorage.net/Alaskans, your source for Anchorage information. This message sponsored by Visit Anchorage.
Aaron Burmeister has taken over the Iditarod lead. The Noah Musher left the Nikolai checkpoint at 12:25 this afternoon. Allie Zirkel followed out of the checkpoint a little less than an hour later, followed by Mitch Seavey, Lance Mackey, and Paul Gebhardt. The Iditarod GPS tracker has the leaders about 15 miles from McGrath at this hour. The top two Iditarod rookies in the field this year are still resting in Nikolai. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Fort Yukon's Josh Kadzow comes from a family of mushers. He started the Iditarod last year with high hopes.
Well, you know, last year I didn't come to expose my dogs to other dogs until, you know, a couple weeks before the Iditarod.
Kennel cough eventually turned into pneumonia, and the rookie was forced to scratch 300 miles before the finish line. This year, Kadzow has taken his dogs to a few races to expose them to other teams, but he knows what his dogs can do.
I'm only 26. But I made a lot of mistakes already in my mushing career and, you know, a lot of major mistakes. So now, you know, I'm just hoping I don't make any more.
You're an old 26.
I'm an old school 26, exactly. You know, I've logged a lot of long miles this year, a lot of training, and I think I've done everything I can do for this team to do their best.
But Kanza will have to keep an eye out for your life, Seth Olsom. The 26-year-old Norwegian brought a few dogs over from Norway this year, and he also has a few wild cards.
I had some bad luck just a week before a race with a few dogs dropping out on me. So I had to take some spare dogs that I had, and they're doing much better than I thought.
Life Seth Olsom is soft-spoken but extremely driven. He's running as part of an educational effort called Racing Beringia. As he shoveled spoonfuls of beef stew into his mouth in Rainy Pass, he said he wasn't paying attention to teams around him, but his competitive nature is likely to keep him up front.
You know, I don't have a clue what's going on. I don't know what place I'm at or who's in front or who's behind me at all. I'm not going to change my schedule just because someone else is in front or whatever, so I just gotta do my thing.
Both Life Seth Olsom and Josh Kadzow have a laid-back attitude about the trail ahead. Without the nerves common to rookie mushers, it could be a mad dash for Iditarod Rookie of the Year. In Anchorage, I'm Emily Schwing.
About 100 state workers held a rally outside the state office building in Juneau last week to show solidarity with union leaders negotiating new contracts. The Parnell administration is currently working out new three-year deals with three public employee unions representing more than 11,000 workers statewide. Republican legislators have come out against raises for those workers. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
What do we want?
Fair contract!
When do we want it?
Yeah!
With the portable sound system on the Fritz, Gordon Wilson Naranjo took matters into his own hands, jumping on the railing of the state office building portico and leading union members in a chant. Wilson Naranjo is a wildlife biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and a member of the Alaska State Employees Association. With about 8,500 members, ASEA is the largest state employee union. Wilson Naranjo says he's disappointed the state isn't offering more of a wage adjustment to workers outside Anchorage.
Here in Juneau, we have a higher cost of living, property value, and there hasn't been that full adjustment, and so I'd like to see that geographic difference. That's my big thing.
According to a recent negotiation update on ASEA's website, the state's initial wage proposal did not include any pay increase in the first year of the contract and only 1% increases in years 2 and 3. The union countered with a proposed 3% increase in year 1 and 2% increases in subsequent years. Jim Duncan is ASEA's business manager.
Well, we still have a ways to go in negotiations. I think we're making progress.
Duncan says the two sides are mostly squabbling over monetary issues right now. The state backed off an earlier proposal to abolish the union's third-party managed health trust, which provides medical benefits to ASEA members and their dependents.
Which was a big issue for us, so they have decided to back off on that. But again, I'm optimistic. We're doing some hard bargaining. They're doing some hard bargaining. That's what the process is about.
Andy Mills, Special Assistant to Administration Commissioner Becky Holtberg, says the state wants balanced agreements for all of its union contracts.
That being one that both parties are happy with.
The state is also negotiating with two Alaska Public Employees Association bargaining units representing about 3,000 workers. APEA's Doug Swanson says talks are focused on wages and health benefits, but he declined to offer specifics, citing the positive state of negotiations.
When things aren't going well, I can complain to you. But when we're real close to being done and things are moving and there's positive momentum, there's not a whole lot I can say to the media or say to anybody, because we don't want to break the momentum.
By statute, the administration must submit labor agreements to the legislature by the 60th day of the session. That's March 15th this year. In an unusual move, legislative leaders are adding their 2 cents during negotiations. In a recent letter to Governor Sean Parnell, House Speaker Mike Chenault, Senate President Charlie Huggins, and the co-chairs of the House and Senate Finance Committees, all Republicans, urged the administration to, quote, hold the monetary terms of the contracts at zero. The letter cites the state's fiscal uncertainty, declining oil tax revenue, and perceived competition with the private sector. Duncan says ASEA isn't worried about lawmakers at this point.
The legislature has a right to express their opinion. I respect that. However, we negotiate with the administration, and once we reach agreement, we'll then go present that to the legislature.
But the letter is a big concern to ASEA member Alan Plotnick, an employment security specialist with the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Did the legislature get their raise? Did they get their cost of living allowance? Do they get their per diem? Do they get their offices remodeled? Yeah, they do. We're all Alaskans. Come on, let's keep the people that we have sustained with a livable income.
The legislature is not considering any bills to limit collective bargaining, and House and Senate leaders have said they have no plans to introduce such legislation this year. But with many states and the municipality of Anchorage acting to limit union members' rights, Plotnick is wary.
You look what happened in Wisconsin, we need to stick together. It's really scary.
Duncan says ASEA and the state have at least two more bargaining sessions before the March 15th statutory deadline for an agreement. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
After decades of lobbying and planning, a project to overhaul the boat harbor on St. George Island is finally moving forward. The state hopes to have fully developed construction plans by 2015. St. George Mayor Pat Pletnikoff says the sooner, the better.
Without a functional harbor, in short order, that community will cease to exist.
Despite being in the middle of the Bering Sea's most productive fishing grounds, St. George's economy is struggling and the population has declined. The community has a harbor, but its design leaves it open to wave action, particularly during the Bering Sea's frequent winter storms. As a result, attracting the fishing fleet's business has been difficult. With improvements to the harbor's design, Pletnikoff is optimistic that St. George can prosper.
Part of the study work that the State Department of Transportation is doing and will continue to do is contact industry people to see what interest they have. We know there's a lot of interest on the part of the crab fleet. They've come into harbor when they can at St. George and drop off crab pots, or they come in to pick up crab pots they have stored on the island.
Last year, Senator Mark Begich also included a provision in the Coast Guard reauthorization bill directing the agency to study St. George as a possible port of refuge for vessels transiting the Arctic. Pletnikoff says that could help defray some of the estimated $30 million in construction costs for the harbor.
Certainly, I mean, if we can get some assistance for development from the federal government, that will be fantastic. But Governor Parnell and his staff have been forthcoming, as has been our legislature. And so, you know, we're optimistic that the funding will be in place for construction in a couple of years and after all the study work is completed.
The state has already pitched in $2.5 million to the project, and voters approved a $3 million bond in November. Bidding on the design phase of the project ends tomorrow, and the state hopes to select a contractor shortly thereafter.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give, or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast is open for business with courses in accounting, information systems, and public administration. Degree programs and courses available online. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
The lawsuit over allegedly defective engines for the state's fast ferries has come to an end. A settlement was announced Friday afternoon in Juneau Superior Court after nearly 3 years of litigation and just before the start of trial. Senior Assistant Attorney General Dana Burke said in court that the Alaska Marine Highway System will get 8 new engines provided by the German manufacturer. There'll be an option for the state to purchase 2 spare engines, nearly at cost. Burke says the settlement also calls for a maintenance agreement and new 5-year extended warranty on the new engines for the fast ferries Fairweather and Chenega.
We've built into this settlement agreement an improved, mutually beneficial working relationship that's going to allow these engines to continue to operate in ferry service from here on out. And it's not just a rhetorical flourish with respect to an agreement to do that. We have binding commitments that make us do that.
Burke promised that the settlement agreement will be made public as soon as all the parties sign off on it. That may happen within the next week. Doug Serdaley is the Alaska attorney for the German manufacturer.
It has taken the parties and counsel working full-time nearly 3 weeks to develop this settlement agreement, and a lot of thought and effort has gone into it. And we both sides think it's a very fair and a very reasonable agreement for both sides.
The state hopes to preserve its interests against Robert E. Director Incorporated, the Connecticut shipyard that built the ferries, and the other defendant in the case. That company is mired in bankruptcy court and is not currently part of the state's lawsuit. 100 years ago this week, the first territorial legislature gathered in Juneau. For the past few days, legislators past and present have been celebrating that event and reflecting on Alaska's history since the inaugural meeting. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez has this story.
It's well into the evening, and members of the Alaska legislature are spread around a cavernous room. Giant American flags are hanging from the walls, and the place is abuzz. That is, until someone strikes the gavel.
The House will return to order. Our next order of business is the second reading of bills, resolutions, and memorials, Mr. Chief Clerk.
House Bill 2 by Representative Shoup,
entitled An Act to Extend the Elective Franchise to Women.
Those two aren't real political figures. They're actors recreating the inaugural meeting of Alaska's first elected body, and the true-to-life legislators sitting before them are just there for a bit of dinner theater as part of the Centennial Commission's anniversary celebration. The commission spent 6 months planning for the celebration, but the reenactment only came together in the last few weeks. The men and one woman cast had just a couple of rehearsals to develop their characters and to learn about one of the territorial legislature's first acts, granting women the right to vote. Phil Smith plays Representative Charles Ingersoll of Ketchikan, and he says it's been a little crazy trying to get the whole performance together.
Fortunately, we have a well-prepared script, and none of us are totally off book, which is... would be next to impossible to accomplish in short order. But it works pretty well because we're situated at desks and sort of orating from our materials.
He says it's a trip to be able to reenact the proceedings in Juneau's Old Elks Club, where the first legislature met. Even the floors are still the same. And Smith says it's been a fun learning experience, too.
I really didn't know anything about this inaugural territorial legislature and the import of their first order of business, taking up the right of women to vote, and so it's been fascinating.
The audience seems to enjoy it as much as the actors do. Senator Gary Stevens is the chair of the Centennial Commission, and when I catch up with him, he's beaming.
Well, this is such fun. I mean, for a retired history professor, it doesn't get any better than this, you know, celebrating the 100th anniversary of the territorial and state legislature.
Stevens says that the Centennial has also been a good time for him to reflect on where Alaska was and where it is now.
The first speech made by the Speaker of the House was against federal oversight, federal overreach, and taking too much control away from Alaska. And the Speaker was talking about how, in 1913, how important it was that Alaska get its fair share, which is exactly what we're talking about today. So things haven't changed a lot, have they?
And if there's one thing that definitely hasn't changed, it's that there's always work to be done. About halfway through the reenactment, all of the members of the House of Representatives in the audience get up from their seats and head to the door for an 8 p.m. floor session. They have some gaveling in to do themselves. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Emily Schwing on the Iditarod Trail, and Casey Kelly and Matt Miller in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.